have trouble putting checklists. Thank you so much. It's nice to be here. Yes, I'll be speaking about MSSM electrode baryogenesis. Whenever I tell people I'm working on this, people ask me if it's ruled out. The answer is not quite, but I'm an optimist, so we can turn around the fact that this setup is very, very constrained experimentally to make some fairly concrete predictions of what goes on. So this is something I'm working on with Arjun Menon at Michigan. Well, let me also say that I've tried to make my slides very simple, but if you download my slides from the website, I have lots of extra slides of background, and I'd be happy to discuss afterwards. Okay, so let me start with the experimental observational facts. What we see in the universe are baryons. The baryon density is very well measured, both through looking at the CMB and looking at predictions of nucleosynthesis. We have a number. The number has a fairly small error. And, this is the number. But I guess the part about this number that I want to concentrate on is that what we see are really all baryons. We don't see baryons. We see matter, not antimatter. And fairly uniformly through the universe, we see matter. And it turns out that within the standard model of particle physics, this is hard to explain. So, for instance, in the standard model, there doesn't seem to be enough CP violation. And CP violation is the only thing in the standard model that distinguishes between matter and antimatter. So this motivates us to look beyond the standard model for other possible explanations. And a very nice way to go beyond the standard model is to add supersymmetry. And supersymmetry is motivated by lots of stuff other than producing baryons. But it's a very nice feature that even if you look at the minimal supersymmetric extension of the standard model, you do find a way to generate the baryon asymmetry. And the way you can do that is through a mechanism called electroweak baryogenesis that I'm going to focus on. Okay, so here's my first cartoon about how this works. So in the early universe, you start off in a very, very hot state. And it turns out that as you crank up the temperature, you restore the full electroweak symmetry, the full Fe2 cross U1. And eventually this symmetry is broken as you cool down. And for electroweak baryogenesis, what we want is for this phase transition to be strongly first order. And what happens if the phase transition is first order is that in your plasma of symmetric phase, this is the symmetric phase plasma, you nucleate bubbles of broken phase. So five bubbles. And these bubbles, if the temperature is low enough, are energetically favored. And once they nucleate, they expand out, and eventually they'll collide and meet up, and eventually fill up all of the space. Now, for electroweak baryogenesis, we want bubbles. We need bubbles. And we need bubbles because all the interesting baryon production mechanisms take place in the vicinity of the walls of the bubble. And so here's my second cartoon of how this works. And I guess you can split it up into three easy steps. So step one, you have particles in the plasma scattering off the bubble wall. And if you have CP violating interactions in the bubble wall, you can generate a chiral asymmetry, a matter-antimatter asymmetry in the vicinity of the bubble wall. So I should add that this is the bubble wall, this is the symmetric phase, and this is the broken phase. Now, once I produce this chiral asymmetry, this matter asymmetry, I still don't have a net baryon asymmetry, but I have a chiral matter-antimatter asymmetry. What happens in that case is that this chiral asymmetry can source Sphalerons. So Sphalerons are non-perturbative transitions. They're present in the standard model, they're present in the MSSM, that violate baryon number. They violate B plus L, to be specific. And it turns out that these Sphaleron transitions, they're related to SU2 leptons and tunnels, by the way. It turns out that these Sphaleron transitions are only active, they only occur quickly with an appreciable rate in the symmetric phase. If I look in the broken phase, these Sphaleron transitions are essentially turned off. You don't see them, they're so slow, they're essentially irrelevant. So what happens is my chiral asymmetry ends up sourcing the Sphalerons and ends up pushing the Sphalerons to produce more baryons than antibaryons. And once I produce these baryons, again, in the vicinity of the bubble wall, here's my bubble wall expanding out. The baryons that I produced get sucked up inside the bubbles into the interior where I have a beta and where my Sphalerons are turned off. So what happens is I produce baryons, the baryons get sucked up into the bubbles, And once they're sucked up into the bubbles, they're stable. Effectively, inside the bubbles, baryon number is conserved. And once I get my baryons into here, my baryons are safe. And I have a net baryon asymmetry. So this is how electric baryogenesis works. Okay, and it turns out that this mechanism really does work in the minimal supersymmetric standard model. In fact, you might be wondering why it might not work in the standard model. Because even in the standard model, all the ingredients I need for electric baryogenesis are, at least in principle, there. But it turns out that within the standard model, at least, it doesn't quite work. So the first shortcoming of the standard model is that it turns out that the electric phase transition is not strongly first order, at least once we impose the bound on the Higgs mass. On the other hand, when we have supersymmetry, we have new particles in the plasma. And these new particles alter the Higgs potential, and they alter the electric phase transition as a result. So as far as the MSSM goes, the new state that we're interested in is a scalar top, or stop. Essentially because this state couples strongly to the Higgs. And it turns out that a light stop, or a stop in the MSSM, can make the electric phase transition strongly enough first order, provided it satisfies two conditions. So the first condition is that it has to be mostly right-handed and really quite light. And by light, I mean, in fact, even lighter than the top forecast. The second condition is that I want this light, mostly right-handed scalar top to have a big coupling to the Higgs. And it turns out that what I need to get that is for the mixing between the left and right-handed stop states to be fairly small. So what I mean by this is, here's my effective coupling of the Higgs to the scalar tops. And it looks like essentially a top U power squared. This is related to supersymmetry, multiplied by a piece that depends on the Higgs mixing, where this xt relates to the left-right Higgs mixing, and essentially this dimensionless combination corresponds to how much left-right mixing I have. So to maximize this piece, I essentially want this piece to vanish, and I essentially get a top quark you call a coupling out. Now, once I've done this, once I've imposed these requirements on the right-handed scalar top, it turns out that I have to take my left-handed scalar top to be really, really heavy. And the reason for this is because of the bound on a standard model like Higgs mass of about 114 GeV. So in the MSSM, it's actually hard to push the Higgs to be this heavy. And the way you do is by putting in big loop corrections from the scalar tops. And once I've made one of the scalar tops light, I need to rely on the other scalar top to make the loop corrections big, and that forces the mass to be high. So I have one light stop, one heavy stop. So this is for the system to make the phase transition strongly for shorter. It turns out that within the standard model, electroweak baryogenesis doesn't work for a second reason. And that second reason is it turns out that there just isn't enough CP violation. Now, in the MSSM, once we add supersymmetry, there are lots of new sources of CP violation. This can actually be a problem in a lot of cases, but here it helps. And within the MSSM, it turns out that we can get enough CP violation. And the main source, at least as far as electric baryogenesis goes, comes from the Higgsinos, the Gaginos, and the mixtures. And it turns out that this is enough for electric baryogenesis to work, provided roughly two conditions are met. First of all, the phase between the mu term and the electric Gagino masses has to be reasonably large, greater than order 10 to the minus 2. And on top of that, these electroweak, these Higgsinos and the Gaginos have to be fairly light. And they have to be fairly light because as they become heavy, they decouple from the plasma, and we need them to be present in the plasma to do their CP violating magic. Now, once we've added this phase, we have to start worrying about violating bounds on CP violation, and in particular on electric dipole moments of various particles. And these come about from diagrams, for instance, of the following form. So here's a fermion, let's say it's an electron, and I have the super partner of the electron, the scalar. And these one-loop diagrams with phases this large are generally problematic if I have light scalars. The way to get around overproducing electric dipole moments from diagrams like this is to suppress the diagrams by putting in a large mass. And in this case, to suppress a large mass, what we essentially have to do to take all the first and second generation scalar fermion superpartners to be really heavy, heavier than an order 5 TeV, unless you have some cancellations. So generically, we need very heavy scalars. So at this point, before I go on to LHC stuff, let me just mention that the requirements of electric baryogenesis have fixed most of the masses of the scalars in the theory. I need a light stop, a heavy stop, and basically all of my other scalars have to be quite heavy. Now, the right-handed Stau and the right-handed B, I might be able to play some games there. But essentially, I have basically very heavy scalars and a light stop. And yeah, actually, at some point, me and my collaborators were calling this stop split supersymmetry.
So when you call this limit down there, it's greater than 5 TeV, you mean the stop can still be light.
Yes, so this applies to the first and second generation scalars.
Okay.
And these are the ones that are relevant for EDM paths. Okay, so as far as the light stop goes, you may be wondering to yourself, well, if you have a light stop lighted in the top quark, why haven't we seen it already at the Tevatron? Well, it turns out that the Tevatron is sensitive to light stops in some cases, but not always. The way to avoid the Tevatron bounds, generically, is to have the light stop be very close in mass to the LSP, the lightest superpartner particle that's stable and you don't see in your detector. And, for instance, if the stop mass difference, if the mass difference between the light stop and the LSP mass is less than about 30 GeV, we don't expect to have seen a stop at the Tevatron. And the reason for this is, when the stop decays, its decay products are fairly soft, and it's hard to pull them out of the background. Now, it turns out that this small mass difference, also has a motivation based on getting the right dark matter abundance. And this comes about, I guess, Ezra mentioned it in his talk, if you have mostly Eno LSP, you generically get too much dark matter. And you generally need something to help you out push down the dark matter density. So now, with a light stop that's close to mass to the LSP, you can arrange for co-annihilation between the stop and the most of Beano LSP, and this will help push down the relative density of the Beano LSP to acceptable levels. And again, this requires just more or less the same mass difference that I needed to get out of the Tevatron bounds. Okay, so...
Excuse me. Co-annihilation, you said?
Yes.
If it's 30 GeV apart and the particles are 200 GeV, it's probably too big.
Well, less than 30 GeV. So the stops annihilate so efficiently that you actually can get away with fairly large mass difference. Okay, so the upshot of the small mass difference with LHC is that even though you're producing bucket loads of light stops at the LHC, they're going to be hard to see. So with the small mass splitting, generally, the dominant decay modes, assuming the neutralino LSP, are my stop, goes to charm, neutralino LSP. This requires some flavor violation, which you generically expect to have some. And what you get out of this, again with a small mass splitting, is, well, missing energy and a charm quark, but the charm is very soft, and it's hard to pull out of background. A second decay mode that can actually compete with the two-body flavor violating mode, if you don't have very much flavor violation, are three and possibly four body modes involving W's and charginos. And again, you run into the same problem finding this mode directly. And the problem being that the decay products are very soft. So for instance, suppose I have a four body mode where this W goes to a lepton and a neutrino. It's nice that I have a lepton, but if it's a very soft lepton, it's still very hard to pull that out of backwards. So because these light stops are hard to see, this has motivated us, and I guess others, to look for ways to look for tricks to find them. A nice proposal by Crummel and Rockla recently is to look at the production of two gluinos, with each gluino decaying into top stop, with same sign tops. And from this, from your same sign tops, if they decay leptonically, you get same sign leptons, and this gives you something to trigger on. And it turns out that this is a possible LHC discovery mode, as long as your gluino isn't too heavy. But the problem is, it's very hard to do parameter determination. And, for instance, in their studies, they don't have charm tagging. So you see a same sign dileptone signal, but it's hard to tell that you're seeing what you actually think you are. Another nice recent proposal by Steve Martin is, with these very light stops, It turns out that they also tend to have fairly long lifetimes. And in some cases, they can form stop-onion, essentially a bound state of stop, anti-stop. And you can look for stop-onion decaying into two photons. This might be possible with a whole lot of luminosity. If it is possible, it's very nice because you actually get an absolute mass measurement of the stop x, which is something that's often hard to come by in supersymmetry. One of the things we're looking at, a fair bit of work has been done assuming the flavor violating decay mode. We're looking at possible new signals with this 3 or 4 body decay mode. So we're still looking into that. It's not looking so great, but we're still digging. Another handle you can try is to look for the electroweak gauginose and higginose, because they have to be light. This is a bit tricky because they're produced through electroweak interactions instead of strong interactions, so their production rates aren't so high. Another difficulty is that often the charginos will decay through a stop, and this makes it harder to find the charginos themselves. So the direct LHC searches can be a bit challenging. So one thing we've been trying is to look at indirect searches for light stops motivated by electroweak baryogenesis through Higgs signals. So it's fairly well known that if you have a light stop, or generally a new light particle, it can modify Higgs production and Higgs branching fractions by running in loops. So for instance, if you look at the coupling of the Higgs to two light stops, again, you'll remember the same coupling came up in generating the first order phase transition. And for electroweak baryogenesis, we essentially want this mixing to go to zero. So this coupling roughly coincides with the topping coupling. Now, in this case, it turns out that we enhance Higgs production through gluon fusion. So the dominant standard model contribution comes through a top loop, where you have gluons going through a triangle diagram at the top, going to a Higgs. Now with the light stop, we have a new diagram with a scalar top. And it turns out that with this coupling, these diagrams interfere destructively. So we get a nice enhancement. On the other hand, it turns out that, when you produce a Higgs through gluon fusion, for light Higgs, you generally expect that the best way to find that Higgs is through the Higgs decaying to two photons. Now with the light stop, it turns out that we actually suppress the branching fraction into two photons, because again, if we take our standard model loop, which is dominated by a W diagram, when we put in the new small light stop loop, it turns out that the interference here is destructive. So we actually suppress this a little bit. But putting them together, things aren't actually too bad. So here is a relatively reasonable, but maybe slightly optimistic case, where I have no top, essentially no left-right mixing in the stop sector, moderate tangent beta, large pseudoscalar Higgs masses, and fairly reasonable Higgs mass. And what I've plotted on this, what I've plotted here is as a function of the stop mass, I have the ratio relative to the standard model of various Higgs processes. So the green line is the cross section for Higgs production through gluon fusion. And between these two dotted lines is a region where you expect to be for electroweak baryogenesis to work. So what we see is a pretty nice, maybe factor of two enhancement in the rate. On the other hand, if we look at the red line, which corresponds to the width into Higgs to gamma gamma, the branching fraction of the Higgs to gamma gamma, we see some suppression, again because of destructive interference. But the suppression isn't quite as strong as the enhancement. And when we put them together and look at essentially the total rate, sigma times branching fraction, we still end up with a decent enhancement. So now, a number of studies have been done trying to estimate how well you can measure various Higgs rates. And unfortunately, because of various uncertainties, it's tricky to do. The error bars are pretty large. But for inclusive Higgs production, dominated by gluon fusion, you can do about 30% relative to the standard model rate. You can do about 20% on the branching fraction into gamma-gamma, and about 15% on the total rate for inclusive glu-glu Higgs to gamma-gamma. So looking at these, we might be able to get order 2 to 4 sigma estimates, or we might be able to see order 2 to 4 sigma deviations from the standard model, depending on where the stop masses lie. Okay, so I'm running out of time, so let me wrap it up. On top of all the other nice things it does, the minimal supersymmetric standard model can account for the baryon asymmetry through electroweak baryogenesis. For this to work, we need a light stop, light electroweak enos, and heavy scalars. And this scenario, especially because all the scalars are pretty heavy and because of the various decay modes, is tricky at the LHC. But one handle we can try to use indirectly is Higgs boson production as a, I suppose, an indirect probe. And finally, let me just say that I guess this is a fairly interdisciplinary conference. And one thing I want to emphasize is just the very nice connection between, or possible connection between collider physics and cosmological physics. And I think it would be just great if the LHC sees new physics that ties into solving some of the cosmological puzzles.
You said that the Higgs production is enhanced now, like glue to Higgs is enhancement. Is there a really dumb, easy way to see that that's true? It's top stop loops, so the thought that it canceled. Is that intuition just wrong?
Let's see. In the limit of the particle running in the loop becoming much heavier from the top, it starts to look like correction to the beta function. And the sign of the correction to the beta function for both fermions and scalars is the same. Whereas for non-abelian gauge bosons, you have an opposite sign. So this is sort of the hand-wavy argument for why the top interferes destructively with the W, whereas it's constructive to the top itself. Yeah. Although you can also modify that if you have a lot of left-right physics. That's my rough explanation. Yes?
So you choose an X of T small or zero to have a large coupling, but you can also choose a very large, like make it three, and then you just have a large coupling.
Well, actually, the coupling I wrote, yes, you can do that, but when it turns out that when you turn up the Higgs mixing too much, you don't get a first order electric phase transition anymore. So essentially, you want a light stop state who gets a mass basically entirely from the Higgs particle.
That's because of the sign on that coupling, so it gives you the potential if you're in the wrong proposition, or?
I guess the way to look at it is as you start mixing it, the light stop state starts getting a mass also from the soft parameters, and not only the Higgs mass. And it turns out that this ends up decoupling the thermal correction that you want to make the phase transition.
Is this picture consistent with electrical moment measurements and is it the variation?
Yes, it is. You get very strong constraints on the theory. And for instance, one of the constraints I mentioned was you have to push the first and second generation scalars to be very heavy. Once you do that, you essentially decouple the one-loop diagrams. There are two-loop diagrams that then become dangerous. And it turns out that you can live with those two-loop diagrams with the current experimental bounds on EDMs. But if these experimental bounds were to increase by, or were to get better by, let's say, 1 to 2 orders of magnitude, it could blow this scenario out of the water. Because the amount of CP violation that you would need for electric baryogenesis to work would be inconsistent with EDMs. If the experimental situation improved by a few orders of magnitude. Oh, you know, it'd be just great, it's awesome. Sure. But I'm saying if they don't see something, this scenario would be in trouble.
You should predict the sign.
I know.
Usually there's a third problem in electric baryogenesis in the standard model in addition to the 2D crystal, and that's the washout condition. That you wash out by a number because of the reverse lateral.
Yes, yes.
And can you comment on that? Do you check that?
That's the same as having a strong enough phase transition.
No.
Well, are you worried about washing out the spout? Are you worried about washing out the Baryon asymmetry by SC2 loss accelerons? That's what comes to the phase transition constraint.
No, the phase transition is just that you actually make the bubbles.
Sorry. You need bubbles, but you need a very strongly first order phase condition. And there's a quantitative requirement that you're roughly, you're at the critical temperature or the critical temperature is greater than about 1.
Right.
Yes, and that's a requirement to avoid washing out inside the bubbles.
Right.
And yes, that's...
So that's the condition.
That's the condition, yes. Not just having a bubble. It's not that hard to get the bubble. But to make it that very strongly first order is the difficult thing to do.